I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. A study in the New England Journal of Medicine earlier this year revealed a breakthrough involving a man using his thought processes to control sophisticated movements in his artificial leg. Also this year, a father made a prosthetic hand for his son using a 3D printer. There was a recent story about researchers working on creating the touch sensation for artificial hands. I even saw a picture of a dog being fitted for a prosthetic leg. Clearly, there is some exciting and important work being done in the field of prosthetics and amputee rehabilitation, including here in Philadelphia. And we have two guests who have joined us on Radio Times. Patricia Shivokas is a professor, movement scientist, and biostatistician in the College of Nursing and Health Professions at Drexel University, also the School of Biomedical Engineering, Science, and Health Systems. And Trish Shivokas, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Alberto Eskenazi. He's chair of the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Moss Rehab, which is here in Philadelphia, specializing in amputee rehabilitation, mobility evaluation and treatment, and gait analysis. I should add he was instrumental in the development of ReWalk, the first commercially viable upright device that enables wheelchair users to stand, walk, and even climb stairs. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. So is this an exciting time to be working in the field of rehab and prosthetics?
For sure. Just the fact that there is so much technology available to us, things that we could have not dreamt before, and being able to bring those into rehabilitation has been an incredible opportunity.
And I'm also thinking about all the incredible research that's being done with brain, you know, brain studies, figuring out how the brain works, how the brain is connected to all of our bodily functions.
It's an incredibly interesting time in the fact that we're able to integrate brain and behavior. So we're not just operating as doing something. The brain controls. And as we move the brain into the loop, and that's part of the process that we've been incorporating over the past few years, this has really helped us to integrate technology into the system, and so we have better movements, more fluid movements, and we're able to see how people are actually learning and looking at what's happening in the brain when people learn.
Well, you know, I have to say, and this sounds so stupid to say it, and especially in front of the two of you, but doing my homework for the show, I just had to sort of acknowledge the fact that the brain is such an amazing organ that allows us to do all these things. I'm waving my hands here. Allows us to do all these things without, quote-unquote, thinking.
Yes, and actually movements. We perform movements so quickly. And when you think that there are microseconds, we are making decisions in these milliseconds in which we make decisions and then carry out those actions. And if we're doing these very fast movements, right, it takes time to then process the information that we're using from different forms of feedback and then make changes into the next behavior.
Sure. You want to add to that? You gave me a grin as I was being...
The issue of walking and chewing gum. You've heard that before.
I have.
And it is true, particularly for those individuals that have a pathology, if they have any problem. What you see is that they really have to focus. They have to concentrate on their movements. And so the brain is so marvelous that it can allow us to do multiple things, multiple tasks, while we are actually walking or moving. The speed at which we can respond, that's how we don't end up falling frequently.
Sure.
So these are just things that are very difficult to replace. When I deal with this on the provision of artificial limbs or an exoskeleton like ReWalk, as you mentioned in your introduction, these things are quite challenging because you're using systems that are very different in controlling what we are trying to do, different than the brain.
Sure, sure. I'd like to ask you about your hand, and I should say to our listeners that you did lose your hand. You were in what, medical school in Mexico?
Yes, that's correct.
What happened?
I was in a chemical accident, and I lost my hand as a result of a chemical burn.
Well, I mean, obviously a very serious burn.
Yeah, it was quite serious, enough that required the amputation of my arm.
Oh, wow. So how far up is your arm amputated?
I have my own elbow. I'm missing my arm just below the elbow.
So how long have you had this prosthetic arm here?
Well, nearly 35 years, so for a while. But it's really amazing how the body can integrate an artificial limb. And you probably noticed my artificial limb for the first 30 seconds that you saw
me. I did, yes.
And then after that, most people realize that there's a lot more than just an artificial limb user.
But I would think, and not to get, you know, too deeply psychological here, but that had to have been a difficult thing just to deal with and overcome psychologically.
It was a challenge, but I think having good family support, having a good healthcare system to help you go through, I think those things really played an important role. I could not overemphasize family and social support as really an integral part of rehabilitation.
And you had to rethink your medical career.
Yes. Not only my medical career, but I was right-handed and now I'm an adopted lefty. So that means that I had to relearn to do many of the tasks that you do with your dominant hand and do them with my left hand. Curiously, even my handwriting, which was pretty bad before.
Well, you're a doctor, right?
That's not an excuse, not a good excuse at least. But my signature remained essentially the same.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it's pretty amazing that the brain, you know, can clearly learn to compensate. But I do most activities. As my kids will tell you, I'm pretty handy because I don't get burned now. My artificial limb doesn't get burned. So I was easy to parade around at school to be sure that I could show how I could do
for
things
show and tell, right?
That others couldn't do. That's right.
Wow. And I would assume for patients, especially at Moss Rehab, where you're working on a lot of rehabilitation, that's got to come in handy.
Yes, I think patients perceive it as handy. I tend not to use this as a way to interact with them because I don't think you have to be a patient who had a heart attack or a heart transplant in order to be a good surgeon or a good cardiologist. But patients do believe that it's an important asset, and if they feel that way, I'm happy to support that.
I'm interested in the kind of research that you're doing, Trish, and sort of where your work is taking us when it comes to prosthetic devices, rehabilitation. What are some things that you're involved in these days?
Well, as a movement scientist, there are two tenets to motor learning: practice and how we organize practice, as well as feedback. So if we take those two tenets and apply them to prosthetics, especially neuroprosthetics, where we're putting the brain in the loop, what happens across the many trials of practice? What happens within those trials? Are you making changes in terms of the presentation of the stimuli and how one responds and the different types of feedback that might be given? As we're speaking,
yes.
I have an undergraduate who's working on this National Science Foundation grant with also a collaborator at Rice University. And we're running through a series of experiments right now using different forms of sensory feedback on virtual prosthetics. And so we have this screen where we're trying to determine slippage when someone has force feedback, vibrotactile feedback, visual feedback, and different combinations, and no feedback. And also simultaneously measuring what's happening with the brain, especially in the area of the prefrontal cortex. And that is the area right under your forehead. So what happens is early in learning, we'll see an awful lot of activation in the prefrontal cortex. As one learns and makes adaptations, we expect to see less activation, and it moves to a different area in the brain. So that study is going on right now, and that's an extension of some of the work that we've been doing with this National Science Foundation grant, which is on neuroprosthetics, using feedback, different forms of feedback, to facilitate learning and get the brain in the loop to eventually go forth and develop a prosthetic that has the brain take over instead of relying on contralateral muscle groups, on something mechanical. Let's let the brain take over, and that will allow for a very seamless integration which's happening in the brain and the body.
Is that part of what this story in the New England Journal of Medicine about a man in Chicago who's now able to, sounds like, navigate stairs, and he has he has this prosthetic leg, but it's sort of all hooked in neurologically.
It's moving along that vein. There are a series of different groups throughout the states and then also throughout the world who are working on prosthetics and integrating what's happening with the brain and right. and behavior. There are some prosthetics that are solely neuroprosthetics, cognitive prosthetics. There are others that are sight prosthetics, ocular prosthetics. So we'll see many different types.
Yeah, I'm interested in this marriage of the brain and these prosthetics. Yeah,
and I think that's really the next frontier. And what you're seeing is some of that research come across, at least in artificial limb control. What we have now is there are two subjects that have been instrumented in the U.S. who have actually a plug in their brain. You can actually plug their controller into the brain. They have in the brain a small sensor that has been implanted, and they can actually control their prostheses directly from their brain, just by thinking.
By thinking.
So there is a young woman from Pittsburgh who's been had a massive brain damage and is unable to move any of her limbs, but she has clear thinking. So what they did is they developed this connection to her brain. She is able to control an external prosthesis, an arm that is sitting on a bench, and she's actually able to drink from a canister as long as she thinks about it. So she can control this artificial limb who can grab the drinking canister and let her bring it to her mouth and drink from it. So this is truly using the brain to control a prosthesis.
And it sounds like, we're almost up in a break here, but it sounds like that's where robotics, I guess, comes into this as well. You're nodding yes?
Yes.
Yes?
And the other point is that the work that we do is the non-invasive right. type of work, which is using functional near infrared spectroscopy or FNIR, which is optical imaging, or electroencephalography, which is EEG. And with this, there are also different projects that have been involved with where we have a brain-computer interface. So with that, your thoughts are controlling the computer.
And then the computer is controlling something else.
Some other device. So this has many applications. We work with ALS patients, working with surgeons at Drexel College of Medicine with laparoscopic surgery. We just have a new supplemental grant on that. So there are many applications with our robotics as well as other areas in rehab.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about smart prosthetics, the latest in rehabilitation research and development. Again, Patricia Shavokas is with us along with Alberto Eskenazi, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Widener Law supports WHYY. Widener Law alumni are serving as judges, corporate lawyers, government officials, and more. In addition to engaging in challenging courses, Widener Law students work on real cases in law clinics. A JD information session will be held on January 11th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Delaware campus. Again, that's January 11th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Registration is available online at law.widener.edu/admissions. Widener Leadership Works.
All this year at Sound Opinions, we've heard albums that hit all the right notes and a few that just can't keep a tune.
Now at the year's end, it's a treat to spend time with only the cream of the crop. This week on Sound Opinions, we unveil the best albums of 2013.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a company monitors social media of students for schools. They say it's not a violation of privacy, it's for security.
We've given access to kids to a much more dangerous vehicle than an automobile, and we've given them no guidance, no governance.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And if you're just joining us, we're getting an update on the increasingly sophisticated world of prosthetic development and amputee rehabilitation. Our guests are Alberto Eskenazi. He's chair of the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Moss Rehab, which is here in Philadelphia. Also with us is Patricia Shavokas, and she's a professor, movement scientist, biostatistician in the College of Nursing and Health Professions at Drexel University here in Philly, also at the School of Biomedical Engineering, Science, and Health Systems. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send me a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. During the break, we were talking about battlefield medicine, as we call it. And Alberto, I'd love to have you talk a bit about that. Obviously, the tragedy of the battlefield, but I know that's been very inspirational in many ways for the field of medicine.
Yes, not only inspirational, but I think important because taking care of our wounded warriors is something that it's critical. These individuals who have sustained primarily injuries to their limbs because of the new Kevlar protecting systems. So you protect their chest, you protect their head with helmets, but unfortunately you cannot protect their limbs. Mm-hmm. And so they end up losing our arms and legs. And there is an incredible amount of work, funded work right now to try to address their needs. When they lose an arm or a leg, being able to provide them with a prosthesis that really reflects on their need for high level of function. Mm. They need to be able to jump, to run, to climb, to be able to return to the kinds of activities they did prior to their amputation. So prosthetic devices are allowing us to do more of that, even prosthetic devices that are self-powered, meaning they have a battery and can actually bend and extend the knee or move mm-hmm. your ankle up or down. And those devices tend to be much heavier, require more maintenance, and certainly are a lot more costly. But for our wounded warriors, we have the ability to provide them with that.
You had mentioned earlier the changing materials, and I'm assuming you've got lighter materials, perhaps materials that are easy to incorporate into someone's body, so to speak?
Not to really incorporate into the body. There are some research projects going into that, something called osteointegration, where you actually put a small amount of metal implanted directly into the bone and then hang the prosthesis.
Wow.
Directly from the bone.
Wow.
But, of course, there are some issues. You have an exposed piece of metal that needs to be surrounded by skin and the risk of infection. The Veterans Administration will start next year the first trial of that in this country. There is already work in Sweden that has been done in this regard, very similar to what they use for dental implants, if you think about it. They mount teeth on these metal pieces directly onto the jaw. So that's the intention, and I think that it will advance our ability to eliminate the friction that the materials produce on the skin. But in general, we've developed lighter materials, able to use much lighter and better customizable materials.
Do you think this is a more collaborative part of medicine, Trish? I mean, I'm listening to the two of you talk, drawing from all these various fields within technology, within health, within medicine, within behavior, computers, all of that?
Yes, I think the past 10 years, what we've seen is the evolution of this integration of brain and behavior. The directive by President Obama with the Brain Initiative has really facilitated more interdisciplinary, but more importantly, the translational type of research that's done.
Yeah, you agree with that?
Rehabilitation is definitely a team effort. There's no one individual that really has the knowledge of all of the pieces that are needed to work with a patient. And so having a team of experts from all fields, nursing, physiotherapy, occupational therapy, speech pathology, psychology, education, are critical to our excellent delivery of care.
How does ReWalk work?
ReWalk is briefly an exoskeleton. It's a device that basically is worn around your body. It is intended for individuals who sustain spinal cord injuries and are completely paralyzed.
Like a quadriplegic, for instance?
A paraplegic. Paraplegic. Yes. You do need to have the ability to use your arms because you need to use your arms to support and balance yourself. The device is basically powered by two small batteries that you wear on a backpack. The system has a computer that is also carried in the backpack. And the device uses body language, gentle tilts of the trunk back and forth as you do when you walk normally to generate stepping patterns.
Huh.
And an individual...
sort of how they move their head and their arms, right?
Well, what they're doing is you're basically moving your trunk back and forth very gently, and that movement is sensed by a small sensor that it's embedded in the system, and then it has in the software, which is the tricky part of this, embedded a mathematical model of walking, and it basically looks at it doesn't allow you to take two right steps, for example. You have to always take a right and a left, and you use your upper limbs to be sure that you're balancing yourself. The system is a system that is self-supported, so you don't have to carry it. It carries you, and it can walk to a speed that is about two-thirds of normal speed of walking.
And can it go upstairs? And
The device can allow you to go up and down steps one step at a time.
Mm.
So you actually have to trigger the system at each step. This is important because, remember, individuals who have had spinal cord injuries have no sensation,
right,
no feedback. So they're using their eyesight to figure out where they are. And we want to be sure that they have their foot on the step as they're going up or down a step.
You're looking very interested and quizzical, yes, there, Trish.
Well, it's interesting to think about with respect to learning and how we could make some changes in setting up in instructional rehabilitation protocols to facilitate this moving about. And in that, let's look at what happens in terms of two-thirds of the speed of walking, which might be a more difficult type of task than if one was walking at their quote-unquote normal speed or their typical speed, or if they walk faster. But walking slower is a more difficult task. You really engage much more thinking in the process.
Well, that's interesting, the idea of quickening the gait, whether that would...
Yeah.
benefit or not. Make sense?
It does make sense once you are very well trained on the system. The reason for keeping it at a slightly slower pace has to do with your ability to react to changes in the environment. Remember, you don't have control over the environment, and so that's an important piece.
Go ahead.
And that's earlier, prior to coming online, Alberto and I were talking about immersive virtual environments. And so as we consider technology and gaming, what will happen is creating these environments that can be safe, but to explore the movement in real time. And this would allow for perhaps a better learning,
right,
and a more transferable or generalizable type of movement for the individual.
Well, and it's so interesting to think of combining these worlds, right? Mm-hmm. The digital world and the analog world. Let me just reintroduce you again, and I do want to get some callers into the conversation. We are talking about the world of prosthetic development and amputee rehabilitation. There is clearly a lot going on. Talking with Alberto Eskenazi, chair of the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Moss Rehab here in Philadelphia. He specializes in amputee rehab, mobility evaluation, treatment, and gait analysis, and again, instrumental in the development of ReWalk, which he just described for us. And also with us is Patricia Shavokas, professor of movement scientist and a biostatistician in the College of Nursing and Health Professions at Drexel University and the School of Biomedical Engineering, Science, and Health Systems. A mouthful there. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments, do give us a call. Let me see what Jan from Newark, Delaware has to say. Jan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a question about whether either of you have worked with anybody who's had a brain aneurysm in the frontal lobe so that the ability to give direction to their legs to move is not functioning from the brain. However, they still can sense their legs. Mm. So I was wondering if there was any way to re-stimulate a portion of the brain, even if they've had an aneurysm and strokes that have come from that. So the person can think, they can sense, they can talk, they can function, their arms can move. I think the torso can move somewhat, but they're paralyzed
sure.
from their legs, from their waist down maybe. Maybe that's what it is.
Jan, let me see what Dr. Eskenazi has to say.
From the perspective of producing new movement out of a brain that has sustained damage, there are many interventions that can be attempted. Sometimes it's not that the brain is not sending signals, it's just that the signals are somewhat disorganized. We know clearly that as time goes on, the musculoskeletal system, not the brain, but the muscles and nerves in the legs do tend to lose their ability to integrate those movements. And so sometimes looking at what is that has occurred there, sometimes years after the original neurological injury, can make a big difference. Simple interventions can change the length of muscles, can change the tightness of the muscles. And by doing that, the brain can be allowed to do more control.
You want to add anything to that, Trish?
I think the only other thing that I would add is the fact that the brain is very plastic and can make changes. So perhaps protocols designed so that other areas of the brain, with sufficient practice
right.
and feedback, would allow perhaps for some movements to occur.
Well, I would assume because you had to switch from your right hand to your left hand, lots of practice, you probably retrained some of your brain.
Yes. Probably if we had some imaging of my brain, what we would see is that I have managed to learn to take over some of the space that was used by my left hand and enhance that so that I can more effectively use it.
I was also reading about some research having to do with touch, and specifically for the hand, I guess, and touch. And one thinks about that, the importance of touch, for instance, but also what seems like the impossibility of how would one create the sensation of touch in a prosthetic hand?
So we were actually having a discussion about that. At Moss Rehab, we've treated many patients who have had either quadruple amputations, meaning they're missing both legs and both arms, or multiple upper limb amputations, and how do you provide that sensory feedback to them? Because it's not only touch. There's touch, there's temperature, there's right. texture. And if you think about your hands are really a door to the world, because you use them to communicate in many ways, but also to interact. You feel the warmth of someone when you give a handshake. So all of these things are very complex to replace. There are some, I'm going to call it rudimentary sensors mm-hmm. that can allow us to perceive temperature, and it translates the temperature into some other form of sensation that gets transmitted to another part of the body, or vibration. Those are the two most frequent ones. But patients actually learn to very interestingly compensate for this in many ways. They use their eyesight, they use their face, they use other parts of their body to try to compensate for this.
To feel?
To
feel. Trish, go ahead.
I agree with what Alberto had indicated in terms of the translational of work from one part of the body to right. the other. And I think that's paramount for us to be able to see the integration of the different senses. So for the development of senses, how can we we could infer some information from the vibrotactile feedback,
right.
from force feedback. But what happens when we could determine differences with these textures? How can we do that? And can we set up some type of virtual environment that would allow different types of, let's say, cyber gloves that might be out there to facilitate fingertip force production? And then how would you attempt to do this in terms of, let's say, a cup? with a smooth surface, with a sandpapered surface? Can you detect those differences and levels of subtlety that could allow for this touch to emerge?
It's so exciting to think about that. I mean, I know that there's certain prosthetic hands where there's grabbing. I mean, there are many things that that hand mm-hmm. can do. I noticed you don't have one of those. Is there a reason for that?
Yes. I wear actually a mechanical hook by choice. I have access to all of the fancy prostheses.
I figured you did.
And many of them are available to me, and I use them. But I prefer a hook for the kind of work that I do. It's actually... It gives me much more sensory feedback.
Does it? How so?
Because I use a harness that goes around my shoulders, and so the tension that it produces every time I open and close gives me sensory feedback. Something that I have not learned to do so well with electronic prostheses, where you only get the vibration of the motor as it's opening or closing. I'll add just one more wrinkle to this, and that has, as you mentioned, our wounded warriors. One of the major challenges is when you have someone who's lost both upper limbs and is blind. Mm. If you think about that now, how such an individual can interact with the world, it's lost vision, a major feedback system, and it's lost sensation. And so those challenges are now hopefully being, we're starting to try to address them. There is a big program through DARPA, the government agency mm-hmm. that helps us fund military projects to develop the DARPA arm, which is basically a prosthesis that will allow full 16 degrees of motion, have sensory feedback, and allow an individual to really sense the world with the use of an artificial limb. We're not there, far from there, but that is really the intention.
And we're about a minute before our second break here, but I just want to underscore, I guess, the importance of one's senses as we navigate through the world, no matter how we navigate, the important role that that plays, Trish, in sort of taking in what's all around us.
Well, I think it also underscores the role of feedback.
Yeah.
So we are taking in information, and that's one part of the process. Then we need to understand that feedback, and we need to process it. That's another part. And in many areas in terms of rehabilitation within this, with prostheses, it's the processing of feedback in working with patients. So if there are cognitive deficits,
right.
processing is impaired. And so the processing is impaired. There's this missing link in terms of this whole loop in the system. Within the military, what we would need is then something in terms of facilitation of the process of feedback, and then using that information to then make some changes in the subsequent behaviors.
Wow. Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We're going to talk more with our guests about smart prosthetics after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
As the calendar pages fall away and 2013 comes to an end, you might be thinking of how to get that last-minute tax deduction. Whether you make a sustaining gift, have your employer match your gift, donate your car, or make a direct IRA rollover to WHYY, time is running out to make a tax-deductible donation. Explore the many ways to support WHYY. Call 1-888-345-WHYY or visit whyy.org/support.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist and screenwriter Delia Ephron tells us about her older sister, Nora Ephron, who died last year. Nora was her writing partner and her role model.
Did you publish before she did?
I think Nora was published when she was born, but no.
Delia Ephron has a new collection of essays. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. We know that children of alcoholics are 4 times as likely to develop substance abuse problems than others, and they're at risk for depression, anxiety disorders, parental abuse, and neglect. But dealing with the issues early in life could make things vastly better.
On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, helping children understand alcoholism in the family. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, again talking with Patricia Shavokas and Alberto Eskenazi. Patricia Shavokas, besides her work at Drexel University, part of the college's interdisciplinary research unit, was selected by the National Academy's Keck Futures Initiative on Smart Prosthetics. This was back in 2007. Alberto Eskenazi, besides his work at Moss Rehab, is instrumental in the development of an exoskeleton for paraplegics, I guess, or people with paraplegia, called ReWalk. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We got an email from Ed, respectfully. He says, I'm a right leg below the knee amputee, and he's very excited about what we're talking about. But he says, this stuff costs a lot of money. So I'm going to toss that over to you for your response.
It is. Prosthetic devices, unfortunately, are expensive. Two major reasons for that. One is that they have to be customized, and so a talented prosthetist has to make a prosthesis. That takes time and effort, and the parts that are used for prosthetic devices are relatively expensive. The reason for that is because of the number of products that are, or number of items that are produced for such levels of amputation. Healthcare reform hopefully will help us with that. It may help us cover for those individuals that are in need. The challenges are still in front of us. It is definitely a worthwhile investment in the sense that individuals who get rehabilitated reduce the cost to the system. The system wants people to go back to work, and so if people are able to do that, then they don't have to depend on the support of others, and they certainly become taxpayers, so which is important for the system.
Trisha, you've been working on these smart technologies or smart, I guess, prosthetics for a number of years now. I'm assuming we're talking about just so much smarter than they were in 2007.
Yes. What we've done, the smart part is integrating the brain in the loop through two different non-invasive measures. The others have been the use of upper extremity exoskeletons with some colleagues. Brent Gillespie at Michigan had really been in the forefront in designing this, as well as Marcy O'Malley at Rice University. So this exoskeleton is a gripper, and this gripper allows us to look at slippage, and that's one of the things that we've been trying to do and incorporate, again, the brain in the loop. The other part is using virtual prosthetics, so using the computer as well as two forms of sensory feedback that we focused on, and that predominantly will have vibrotactile as well as force feedback, so from some device or from EMG, and how someone uses that those haptic forms of feedback to make changes in their behavior to become more fluent with this exoskeleton, or simulating the exoskeleton and gripping types of behaviors on a computer.
But it's so interesting using gaming technology, right? I mean, and why wouldn't you?
Yes.
When one thinks about it, because of the worlds that can get created there, and also how sophisticated they are.
Yes, and I think the next move really will be more immersive. So you have the person has some type of glove or some type of sensor on their body, or where their hands would be on the prosthetic. And let's say that you're trying to perform these games and do the games, and let's see what's happening in terms of the brain, the output. Are you winning the game, however that might be?
Reaction and then, time, all that.
Right, as well as what's happening with the different muscles in the body.
Let me get, looks like Mylan from West Philadelphia to join our conversation. Mylan, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hi, Dr. E. I was hoping that you might be able to speak to ways in which the research into advanced technology helps or applies to low-end or low-technology prostheses, not only here in the U.S., but in third-world applications, but just prosthetic applications that can be widely applied
very inexpensively.
Okay. Mylan, thanks for the call. Yes, go ahead.
Definitely, you know, developing high-end devices helps develop better low-end prosthetic devices. And we see that in the automotive industry. You see cars that develop airbags initially for the very fancy cars, and then they move down to the rest of the automobiles that we use. Same is true with many other applications. And so as technology improves, we learn about how to do things better. Then we can make them less expensive. And in doing that, we can roll out those materials out to everywhere, not only the third world countries, but also to other advanced countries that need less expensive devices.
I was reading about 3D printing. A dad that 3D printed a hand for his son. I don't know if I was reading the Weekly World News or The Onion, or whether I was reading the real thing.
No, that is something that has developed in terms of the 3D printing, where you can develop devices. I believe it was developed at the University of Washington, Seattle.
Yeah.
And there is a young boy at Marblehead, Massachusetts, who is using this device now. Yeah. And can move around.
Yeah, pretty exciting stuff.
Super exciting. I mean, the fact that you could have a printer at home, that costs a couple thousand dollars and can actually help you print a piece of material that you can wear is incredible. Of course, the materials that were used were not ideal, and they could break and other things. But beyond that is, I think, the starting point for many things to happen. The other application of this type of technology using 3D printing, recently there was a beautiful beautiful reporting that was done on art in prosthetics. Mm-hmm. And they did 3D printing of these new covers for artificial limbs, and they're just incredible.
Mm. Well, in fact, we were on the trail of a British artist that we wanted to get in on the show, because she has done these just amazing paintings, really, that she's done on prosthetics.
Yes.
Unfortunately, we could not make contact with her, but we tried in every way that we could. Let me get looks like Marianne from South Jersey to join our conversation. Marianne, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Marty. My call is about my husband, who had ulnar nerve severed at birth. He's 60 now. At the time, the only alternative was to have his wrist and shoulder and elbow pulverized so that his arm would just lie flaccid. Ooh. But he had good parents who rejected that. But through the years, his left elbow extends with his lower arm down, and he's able to pull his hand toward his chest, but not able to push it away. He has remarkable reflexes everywhere, except limited in his left hand. However, he plays the French horn.
Wow.
And very well. But now that he's 60, he has so much pain in his right shoulder and neck for overcompensating in holding musical instruments, and not that should be held by both arms. So he's worried about surgery.
Sure.
And I was wondering if someone who has ulnar nerve damage has, are there any customizable light material braces that could be used that probably incorporate technology as well? He's had very awkward, uncomfortable braces through his adolescence, and
sure,
they were heavy. They abraded his skin. But I would be very interested
sure,
in hearing
too.
How Shavokas and Eskenazi think of ulnar nerve damage.
Well, let's find out.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome, Marianne. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. You should tell us what kind of damage we're talking about.
This is unlikely to be only an ulnar nerve. The damage that it's being described is probably more consistent with a brachial plexus injury. The nerves that come out of the neck, and as they're coming out of the neck, get damaged at birth, either because the arm is in an awkward position or gets stretched. And the portion of the roots that go into the specific nerve got damaged. The color, certainly, I think makes it very clear that even with a severe injury, an individual can overcome many things. Become a French horn player is not an easy thing for someone who has two hands that work perfectly. So this is quite amazing to me. In regard to the use of orthotic devices, which would be basically an exoskeleton for the shoulder, the technology is not very advanced. The shoulder is a very complex joint that has multiplanar movement. If you think about it, it has to move in essentially 180 degrees up and down and then side to side. So it's a very complex joint. The idea of putting a brace around that would not necessarily assist. The only idea would be to reduce pain, and that is to bring the shoulder in a better position because probably it's stretched over time, and that is what's causing pain. But it would be intended to use that when he's not playing the French horn.
I hear you. Anything you want to add to that, Trish?
I was just trying to think of a way to solve the problem.
Yeah, I could see you thinking about how to solve the problem.
I was thinking of a medium of water. And with that, if you had something like an exoskeleton, which wouldn't necessarily be connected to the person, and it might be, let's say, a wall of water, almost like a mini aquarium in front of one, and that would hold the French horn to then allow it to move, and that would reduce the pressure, and there would be some linkage to that device, to this aquarium,
right,
and than the man playing the horn. Right. So I was just trying to
that's
think.
That's interesting. Well, and she mentioned the fact that her husband is 60, and as we all know, we're part of this aging baby boomer generation. I'm assuming, Trish, that means thinking about what happens to people's bodies over time as they grow older, even a greater need for what we've been talking about, prosthetics and rehab.
Yes, and you think about the use of the hands, as Alberta had noted. That's our gateway into doing things. And as we use the hands, we use them so much. Let's look, for example, at some typical overuse. People who keyboard a lot, people who knit, end up having carpal tunnel syndrome. So are we having this overuse syndrome throughout different joints in the body? Can we make use of what we understand of facilitative devices, assistive devices in some fashion to allow us to perform better for a longer period of time?
Hmm. You want to add to that?
Yes, by all means. I think that the point is very correct, which is we do have lots of overuse. We do work very hard our joints, probably more than what we did in previous generations because of the kind of work that we do, and we exercise less. So if we can keep strength, keep range of motion, and look at ways in which we can make devices that are more easy to use, less stressful to use, it would all help our joints in the long run.
Let me see what Mohammed from Fishtown has to say. Mohammed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I'm a pediatrician from Iraq, and I studied biomedical and bioengineering. 30 years ago, I was at Salt Lake City, University of Utah, and I came up with this exoskeleton for, rehabilitating cerebral palsy. And I couldn't convince any professor there to take it as a research topic, because there was no personal computer at that time, 84. And I tried, to tell them that there is an alternative rehabilitation in Bulgaria for cerebral palsy. What they use is elastic, huge elastic bands, and they tie up the patient and they force him to use his arm so he could, get better function. So, ironic that nowadays it is a common place to have an exoskeleton.
Well, Mohammed, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I think it just underscores the fact that this stuff, this development has been happening so quickly.
Yes, I think that, it's been only 20 years that we've seen major changes in many of these devices, and I clearly understand the caller's idea. It's something that we've moved beyond using rubber bands to actually use robotics to help us do that. We have some 16 robotic devices that we use on clinical application, all of them which basically can produce resistance or assistance or guidance and give some visual feedback to the individual to try to help them learn how to correctly do their movements.
We're just about out of time here, but I'm interested how you got interested in this whole rehabilitative prosthetic development.
One of my interests always has been in learning, and in particular in transfer. And when you look at what happens when we perform different tasks and we make changes in our behavior, but then we're presented with some new type of stimuli, how do we change? And how are we able to do this, especially time after time, and what happens with the brain? And so the linking of the brain behavior and what happens in terms of learning. It was forced by the Smart Prosthetics conference by Keck Futures.
Yeah.
And with that, I was always interested in transfer. And so it just made me really start to think of how can we make these changes and what's happening at the brain at the same time. We look always at the outcome. Did we hit the target or not? How close were we to the target? But what's happening with the brain at that same time?
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion. My thanks to both of you for joining us today. Patricia Shavokas, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Marty. My pleasure.
You're welcome. And Alberto Eskenazi, thank you very much as well.
It was my great pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you with us, and we all learned quite a bit. And also a shout-out to Jessica Crocker, our intern. She produced this hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer, the show produced by Susan Green. Bomb, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant with Sophie Reed today. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.